Welcome to episode 133 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Gary Forencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. I have two newsworthy items. First is the Perseid meteor shower are active and will be active probably at least till the end of the month. So if you are interested, go outside on a nice clear night. You need to probably be out for at least 30 minutes so that your eyes adjust. And this is supposed to be one of the more spectacular seasons. The second newsworthy item comes from the FDA. They recently just approved yet another monoclonal antibody for the treatment of patients with dementia. So far, I've looked at the data, and they don't look all that impressive, yet the FDA chose to approve it. More importantly, though, is that within the last few days, they approved the very first over-the-counter oral contraceptive. So yet another option for women.
The good, the bad, and the whatever. They completely bamboozled the NPR reporter who bought into the 35% relative reduction in, progression or something like that, when they acknowledge in the article upfront what the minimal clinically important difference is. And at 18 months, they hadn't gotten anywhere near it. And yet it's just a classic. It's classic.
Just imagine anyway. Mark screaming at his radio.
Yes, you don't have to imagine if you're my wife. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want them all, go to essentialevidenceplus.com. You'll get a great poem in your email daily, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit from the IAFP.com on their online IFP education webpage. This week, we're going to discuss point-of-care bilirubin tests for neonatal jaundice, a guideline for evaluating children in close contact with abused children, early return to activity after concussion, and terminology preferences by patients being treated for substance use disorders. Let's talk about language. Kate, tell us about these point of care Billy tests and what's changed.
I would love to. So these researchers identified studies comparing point of care Billy tests with lab-based tests in newborns ages 0 to 28 days of life. That's the definition of a newborn. I guess that makes sense. So the point of care tests had to be portable handheld devices capable of providing results basically, again, at the point of care within 30 minutes and used either whole blood or serum. They were just finger stick or heel stick devices. The authors found 10 studies, including about 3,000 neonates. All of the studies took place outside the U.S., where I think these devices are a little bit more common. 8 of them evaluated a device called the Billy Stick, and 2 of them evaluated a device that's now known as the Billy DX. And the previous name is really close to Billy Stick, so I'm going to call it Billy DX as I talk about it today. 4 of the studies were considered to be at low risk of bias. All of the Billy Stick studies reported that the device slightly underestimated the serum bilirubin compared with the lab-based testing. Obviously, you don't want to be underestimating in this particular clinical scenario. In one of the Billy DX studies, the device overestimated it slightly, and it underestimated in the other study. So that's sort of the bottom line. Compared with lab-based testing, they underestimated it by what feels like a trivial amount. It was 0.013 milligrams per deciliter. But the 95% confidence interval was from about 1.3 to about 0.88 of the serum level. So that gives you about a roughly 2-point swing in confidence overall. The Billy Stick test used a fraction of a milliliter of blood. Billy DX used a similar fraction of a milliliter of blood. Lab assays also used the maximum amount of blood that they used, if you remember those microtubules that they used to get blood out of a baby's heel. The max that they used was 1.5 mLs of blood. So we're not talking about a substantial difference. The frequency of not being able to get a result at all with the point of care test did vary substantially between 1.5% and almost 50%. So it failed about up to 50% of the time, compared with 1.3 to 2.5% for the lab-based test. So when something was really on the line, lab-based test was better. It is worth noting that the Billy DX device was developed specifically for low resource settings. In our live courses, we've covered some of the neonatal jaundice studies and have touched on some of the other ways for screening newborns for jaundice, including something called a standardized icterometer that you hold to a baby's nose, and it gives you different degrees of yellowness, which takes adds a little bit of standardization to just eyeballing the baby. We also talked about a solar-powered light box called a Billy Hut. In this setting, where the alternative is just to eyeball the baby without any kind of standardization or just to take a best guess, that plus or minus 2 points is obviously better than nothing. It definitely standardizes it, is definitely going to give you a better sense of whether this baby is potentially going to need phototherapy. But when making treatment decisions in a well-resourced setting, a serum Billy is still recommended. Obviously, a lot of folks use the transcutaneous to sort of make those next step decisions in terms of whether the baby does need to go on to need a serum Billy or not. So that's the that's what's new. That's what's changing in terms of these point of care bilirubin tests. Henry.
Thanks, Kate. I don't know what to make of studies like this because they're not the standard diagnostic accuracy when you're dealing with, is this bad Billy or not? We don't have that kind of sensitivity and specificity. All we know are performance characteristics. And so the big question is whether these are good enough. The high failure rate, the one study that was almost 50%, is rather alarming. If there was a way to overcome that, then this could potentially be good enough for most circumstances. Remember, the kernicterus problem is largely in RH incompatibility and acidotic newborns. And so in a high-risk situation where this may be more critical, we might have to rely on the serum Billy. But for all of the other circumstances, this may just be good enough.
Gary, any comments?
The icterometer just really intrigued me. It reminds me of a urine dipstick, basically.
You'd like this because you talk about the oculometer in when you're lecturing about, you know, just eyeballing something, and that's one of the instruments.
This is an oculometer study. I love that. Yeah. Or the previous ones.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for that, Gary. You've got the quiz.
I do. A 35-year-old person comes to your office for a wellness visit. This person's been struggling with their weight for many years and say they're now ready to make some lifestyle changes. They're healthy, taking no medications, and the exam reveals normal vital signs, but a BMI of 36. This person's heard about intermittent fasting and would like to know what evidence there is for its effectiveness for weight loss. In response, you tell this person, number one, intermittent fasting has been proven to be effective in weight loss programs independent of calorie restriction, or B, intermittent fasting's yet to be studied in a controlled clinical trial, C, intermittent fasting's been shown to be associated with serious metabolic adverse effects, and or D, the effect of intermittent fasting on weight loss is primarily a function of calorie restriction. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Gary. Henry, we're going to stay on the theme of wellness and healthcare of children, and you're going to talk a little bit about evaluation of abused children.
Yeah, so actually it's not about abused children. It's about the contact children of abused children. I'll define that in just a moment. This is an international consensus group statement. I think it's an ad hoc group that was published in JAMA Pediatrics in May. So they used systematic reviews to try to guide their development. And yet there's an awful lot of kind of consensus. We think this is probably the best evidence for managing contact children. And they defined a contact child as an asymptomatic child who is also either a sibling, a household member, or in the same care setting as a physically abused child. Okay, it's a rather unique circumstance. And the focus on this was for children under 5 years of age. And when they looked at all of the data, they really didn't find a great deal. But they said, you know, children under 2 years of age, because of vagueness of history and physical that we might need to treat them a little bit differently. So first of all, they say you should do a full evaluation, clinical assessment, history and physical of any child who fits in that category. But if they're under 2 years of age, they should also undergo imaging, regardless of the findings. Older children, if you have any clinical indication, then you should proceed with either a skeletal survey plus an MRI of the brain. So let me just summarize what they said. So do a history and physical under 5 years of age. If the child is younger than 12 months, you should do an MRI of the brain. And if there's an abnormality, you do an MRI of the spine, but they should also have a skeletal survey. Children between 12 and 24 months of age should just have a skeletal survey, but do an MRI only if you have suspicions. Okay. Children who are over 2 years of age who don't have any indication by history or physical, you don't need to do any specific routine imaging. Anytime you find an abnormality, either on physical examination or on imaging, they have some specific follow-up recommendations, but specifically that you should treat them as if they were an abused child. So the big questions in all of this are, what is the yield and what is the implementation burden that they really don't assess?
Yeah, I think we had a study a little while ago, Henry, didn't we, that looked at this evaluation of contact children. And I think those authors concluded that there was some benefit to that, but that was a relatively small study. I remember seeing that a little while ago. So when they say setting, a child in the same setting as the abused child, that's a household setting?
Household setting, daycare.
Oh, really? So, daycare as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, good to know. Any thoughts, Gary?
Well, I just wonder what a positive finding would be, right? You know, it's not defined.
Yeah, they didn't really define what those were. They assumed that clinicians experienced in evaluating children for abuse. You know, if you see behavioral disturbances, you see a battle sign, you see bruising, frequent falls, those kinds of things that you would certainly raise some red flags about.
Great. Thank you, guys. The next study is early return to activity improves symptoms in children with concussion. So another childhood study. This was in pediatrics by Chauhan and colleagues. The study was called Activity and Recovery Among Youth with Concussion, a Meta-Analysis. It's from 2023. And their question was, is prescribing rest an appropriate treatment for kids who are recovering from concussion? That's been the traditional recommendation. But the question is that really necessary or beneficial? So this was a systematic review. They looked at four databases. They found 24 English language studies, including 10 randomized trials of kids, to determine the effect of activity on symptoms, on quality of life, and on their ability to return to pre-injury activity levels after a concussion. They followed the standard guidelines for reporting and conducting a meta-analysis. Results from the randomized trials were combined for a meta-analysis. In the 7 randomized studies that had common outcomes, total of about 270 participants, symptom resolution was somewhat better in kids who returned to normal activity rather than adhere to a prescribed rest period. The standardized mean difference was 0.39. That's moderate, sort of low to moderate benefit. Quality of life wasn't affected by rest versus return to normal activities, and the rate of return to pre-injury levels couldn't be assessed, wasn't studied and reported by enough of the studies. For the studies' outcomes that could be combined, there was no evidence of heterogeneity, so the studies were consistent. The risk of bias was assessed at high in the randomized studies, mainly because they couldn't really mask kids to their treatment assignment. Publication bias wasn't reported. These were relatively small studies, and there is this thing called small study bias, where small studies tend to be methodologically a little less rigorous than larger studies. So bottom line, kids who've experienced a concussion should not be placed on bed rest, but instead can return to their previous activity level as allowed by the development of new and worsening symptoms. So kind of play it by ear and let them return to activities as tolerated. Does that make sense to you, Gary?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also there have been some studies I've looked at in terms of return to participation where they've actually randomized children, mostly adolescents, to either bed rest or sub-symptom threshold aerobic activity like walking on a treadmill and the like. And I think those studies probably may have been part of this meta-analysis, but clearly I think at this point the evidence suggests that basically allowing kids to get back to activity levels to the point where they have symptoms and then backing off seems to be the best course of action in terms of rapidity of by which they can get back to their normal activity.
Kate, do you agree?
Yeah, I think it wasn't mainly bed rest. It was cognitive rest that, you know, so screen free, stay out of school, which we've learned isn't good for people in general when they're, you know, in the case of a giant pandemic or when they're trying to recover from something that, like we were saying, that sort of return to more normal activity is probably good. I think of this, I guess, as like, this is grandma advice, right? Like everybody's grandma is like, you're good. Like just get back out there. And if you start to feel sick, then, you know, then sit down for a few minutes. Rather than, you know, the sort of more like helicopter parent where it's like, oh, my precious dear, you know, you've been sick. Why don't you take it easy? So I think, you know, grandma was probably right, was more right anyhow.
I definitely had a grandma parent.
Yeah, as did I.
Yeah, Henry, you've done a lot of sports medicine. I wonder if you have some thoughts on this.
This is very consistent with most of the, including a BOGSAT guideline released probably about a decade ago, which was, as Gary pointed out, graded return to activity levels based on symptoms. And so, you know, rub a little bit of schmutz on it, walk it off, not quite that that level. You know, it's really a matter of letting your body tell you when you've done too much.
Yeah, Henry, I remember when I was at Michigan State, I think you were the team physician for the lacrosse team, weren't you?
Yeah, lacrosse, correctly? Track and field, and then I did some fill-in for some of the other sports.
Yeah, I remember going to a lacrosse match and thinking, wow, that is a crazy sport. I can imagine there being more than a few head injuries in lacrosse. Probably had some direct experience of that.
I think we're expecting new concussion guidelines soon, if memory serves.
All right.
We'll wait, look,
stay tuned. Gary, speaking of staying tuned, we got your let's see, do we have – oh, we're not on there yet. We've got to go to Gary for the terminology
study. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
So the clinical question in this study is, what terminology is preferred by patients who are being treated for substance use disorder? This was published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine earlier this year. In terms of background, identifying preferred terminology in any aspect of medicine is important, obviously, because language and terminology surrounding medical conditions and people who have them is a conduit for propagating stigma. So the question is, how do we make people feel welcome and feel, you know, basically valued and respected? And certainly it's because of this anticipated stigma from clinicians, you know, partly perhaps based upon previous negative experiences, that can attenuate the likelihood of a person either entering or not some substance abuse treatment and retention and ultimately seeking healthcare in general. So this was a study, outpatient. The investigators surveyed 450 English-speaking adults who were enrolled in a single Northeast U.S. institution for methadone treatment. The participants filled out a paper survey in their first visit, and they used a 7-point Likert scale, scoring 6 or 7 to indicate agreement with the preferred terminology. The highest rated terms for the presenting problem preferred by the 450 people seeking treatment were addiction, substance use, and substance abuse. And interesting, the least preferred were drug misuse and substance misuse. So I thought that was kind of interesting, actually, misuse versus use and et cetera. And substance-related disorders was also one of the least preferred terms which they prefer to be called clients, quite frankly. And as you might imagine, there were some other phrases in which the participants were less likely to be enamored, such as an addict. In terms of personal descriptors, they preferred person with an addiction. And we're used to thinking about this now in many aspects of medicine. You know, this is a person with diabetes as opposed to a diabetic, that type of thing. This is a person with a substance use disorder as opposed to a substance dependent person. And the most disagreeable terms, not a big surprise, were junkie and druggie, which almost everybody said they didn't really prefer. When asked about whether they should be, referred to as patients or consumers. They prefer to be referred to as clients, which I thought was interesting also. And customer being perhaps the least likely preferred with regards to how they want to be referred to in terms of their role and treatment. Didn't seem to be any different responses by gender. So the bottom line, words do shape reality. People starting methadone treatment prefer to be referred to as a person with an addiction, person with a substance use disorder, et cetera. And actually, I thought this was a really, really interesting study. I'm not sure I've seen a previous study like this before. It's not necessarily my area of you know, academic interest, but it was quite interesting.
Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, some of this, I guess we all could have guessed that perhaps we should avoid drunkie and juggy, junkie and druggy when referring to anybody, particularly.
Well, it's a practice changer for me, that's for sure.
Well, you're always the outlier.
Thank you.
But yeah, so client, that's commonly used in mental health settings. So I think patient perhaps is still, you know, okay in that in our, you know, more medicalized situation. But I thought it was interesting that people who participated in 12-step programs did sometimes prefer addict. They identified with that as something that they took to. So that may be something that we do pull out a little bit depending on the patient's specific situation.
Yeah. Henry, comments?
So, Gary, as you pointed out, words have meaning. And even though our terminology, our medical terminology, tends to be static, their meaning evolves over time. And I think it's important that we revisit this periodically to make sure that we are continuing to address people with the respect and dignity that they deserve, and that the terminology doesn't seem to connote other more offensive kinds of phrases. And this is not a new concept, at least in the last couple hundred years. Sir William Osler is thought to be one of the great medical educators and clinicians of our time. He said, I'm paraphrasing, he said, tell me not about the disease a person has, but about a person with the disease, which is very consistent with what these clients were requesting.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of these kinds of studies that talk about terminology. I remember one about how to talk about ending screening or how to stop screening in somebody where it's probably no longer effective, and some other studies similar to that. So I think this is really important. A lot of medicine is about helping our patients make a change, and I think how we talk about that and how we address them can be important and can make us help us be more effective in that.
And I would add to that, Mark, what we put on our problem list, right? Because now patients are having increasing access through portals and the like to their medical record. And, you know, obesity is a stigmatizing term. And, you know, so, we, I mean, there are other, and this is just a generic issue that we need to be more sensitive to how people feel about how we put labels on the conditions that they actually present with.
Yeah, after watching I don't know if our listeners remember Seinfeld, but there was an episode where Elaine had difficult patient written into her medical record. And every time she went to see another doctor, it got carried along and she was treated poorly because they assumed she was going to be a difficult patient. So don't write that in the record either. Gary, you got the quiz answer.
I do indeed. So the answer was D, if you remember exactly what D was. The effect of intermittent fasting on weight loss is primarily a function of calorie restriction. The real question is there any added value to these periods of intermittent fasting? So also known as time-restricted eating. Obviously, this has been pretty wildly popular over the past several years. There are three of the most widely studied intermittent fasting regimens include alternate day fasting, one day on, one day off, fasting 2 out of 7 days, and then during a day, time-restricted eating during the given, you know, 24-hour period. There was a 2022 randomized clinical trial of patients who were overweight and found that the amount of weight loss from intermittent fasting was not significantly different from the control group, the group that was only participating in calorie restriction. They also found that the reduction in body fat and metabolic risk factors also did not differentiate between those who were intermittently fasting and following calorie restriction versus those who were just calorie restricted alone. And so long story short here, the intermittent fasting really hasn't been shown to be associated with an enhanced amount of weight loss. On the other side, Hasn't been associated with harm either. There's been no serious metabolic effects as well. So it appears that, you know, if somebody wants to engage in intermittent fasting for reasons perhaps other than weight loss, it certainly, there doesn't seem to be any downside to it.
Yeah, and it may be easier to adhere to something like that than other ways to restrict calories. So certainly sounds like nothing wrong with it. And if it works for somebody, then we shouldn't discourage it. Excellent. Thanks, Gary, Kate, and Henry. Appreciate your input today. Remember to go to the ifp.com for the CME credit if you go to their online education webpage. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about Primary Care Update. Rate us on iTunes and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. That'll help us get more listeners. And we'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.